Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to Working, the show about what people do all day. I'm your host, Jordan Weissman, and this week we are once again heading to the waterfront, because it's summer, and why the heck not, right? Everyone loves the ocean. Previously, I interviewed the head of the New York Aquarium. I interviewed a tugboat pilot, and after all that, I kind of got hungry. I was just like, I wanted seafood. And so I was sort of sitting around. It's like, you know, what's like an iconic bit of New York City seafood? Oysters. Oysters actually like built New York City. The oyster trade was a huge part of this city's origins. And so I went looking around to find some oyster farmers, because I just thought that would be an interesting and fascinating job, seeing what it's like to raise bivalves. Eventually, I found Mike and Isabel Osinski, who run Widow's Hole Oyster Farm off in Greenport, New York. It's sort of at the very far end of the North Fork. If you just take the train as far as you can into Long Island, you will eventually get there. In a very, very beautiful little patch of the bay. The two of them used to write software for Wall Street in their last career. And once they got done with that, they said, screw it, we're going to raise shellfish. And I talked to them about that while sitting on their lovely porch and while sampling some of those oysters. It was great. Anyway, I hope you enjoy. What are your names and what do you do?
I'm Isabel Osinski and I'm an oyster farmer.
I'm Michael Osinski and I'm an oyster farmer. I'm married to Isabel Osinski.
And tell me about your oyster farm.
Well, we have the Widow's Hole Oyster Farm in Greenport, New York, which 100 years ago was the oyster capital of New York. And, you know, we came out here and we bought a summer house. And we had a software business in New York that we sold and we retired. And we discovered we owned 5 acres underwater by accident. And we decided it would be a good place to raise kids out on an oyster farm. And we now farm for 20 years now, or almost 20 years, 18 years, we farm oysters and bring them in mostly into Manhattan.
Is 5 acres like a lot?
It's enough to grow several million. If you know, we only use, you can see here, 5 acres. We only use an acre of our five, probably less, half an acre.
It's enough.
It's enough.
Yeah.
Plus, we have a creek.
So you guys are sort of like a boutique oyster farm, would you say?
Exactly.
Or where in the range of oyster farming would you say you fall?
High end.
High end.
Yeah. High end restaurants.
Mom and pop boutique.
Hi, Mom. Right.
Family, actually, family farmer, kids work.
Yeah, our kids have grown up here, and they're off both in the university now. Of course, we'll plug them. We got a daughter who's a senior at Cornell who wants to take over the oyster farm, Susanna, and we have a son that's a sophomore at Yale as a engineering student who designed a lot of the system you see, this cushy system that's behind you here.
Oh, really?
Yes.
It's just like a fun project for himself? Or
We told him we couldn't go leave until he figured out how the two of us could manage without him.
It's like, we raised you, we sent you to Yale, you're paying us back.
Yeah. Take care of it.
And this system does reduce our labor by about 75%. It's quite ingenious.
Oh, wow. Oh, okay, we're definitely going to talk about that. Out of curiosity, what restaurants do you sell to?
11 Madison Park in the city is our biggest client. We sell to Le Bernardin. We've sold to Le Bernardin for almost 20 years. He was one of our first clients. Eric Repair. We sell to Blue Hill at Stone Barns, buys oysters from us. We grow a special 5-year-old oyster for Dan Barber, Chef Dan Barber. We sell to Frenchette, which was named the best restaurant of the year last year, 2018. Riyadh Nasser and Lee Hansen are great guys.
Anita Lowe, we sell to her.
Yeah,
we sell to her for special events. She's also
world-renowned chef.
Women, so you're telling me some small, obscure restaurants no one's ever heard. Yeah.
Well, we sell to those too.
As well as those two. Yeah.
We'll sell to anybody.
You found you had this underwater real estate. But what made you decide to actually start raising oysters?
Well, we had two little kids. We knew that this village had been the oyster capital of New York. No one was growing oysters. And, you know, we'd had a successful business on Wall Street. And did we want to go back and, write more software or, or raise our kids in the city life. And, you know, this whole raising kids in the city has got a nutty sort of atmosphere to it. It's very strange. For example, when we were still in the city, our daughter was 2 and she was ready for nursery school. So we went to the local nursery, hoity-toity nursery school, open house, and, you know, Susan Sarandon's daughter went there, and it's like, wow, what's so good about this place? And, oh, the mother said, this is a great school. I said, well, what exactly do you like? She said, they really prepare your child for their kindergarten interview. And I thought, you know, that is so stupid. And I'm sorry, but that is, and that's what the whole school raising kids in New York City is about.
I grew up in New York and I had a kindergarten interview.
Right.
It's insane.
And,
so,
you did very well,
I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, they have you play at the blocks and draw some pictures and try to figure out if you're going to go to the Ivy League from that.
But our kids were driving boats when they were 3. I mean, it's hard to believe when I see little kids, but our kids were driving a boat when they were 3. They were cranking cages, 4 years
and
old.
We jailed them.
Yeah.
You missed the cage. Now we got to go back and work an extra 15 minutes.
Wait. You had the kids.
Standing on milk crates so they could see over the oyster cages and driving. And we would then use the boat hook to grab the buoy, you know, lift it up and hoist it into the boat. Because that requires a lot of effort, strength. But a kid can drive a boat on a tiller and they could do it.
Is that OSHA?
No. Our lawyer, from when we got the buyout, our buyout lawyer told us, he came here to visit, and we told him we were starting a farm, and he said, you know, family farms are exempt from child labor laws.
Yeah, that's why. Okay. I cannot imagine anyone would have allowed me to drive a boat or anything at age 3. I had a power wheel, and I was enough of a menace on that.
I'm a little shocked because we get people come here for tours, and their little kids are running around, and I'm like, I cannot believe we let our kids. And then, on top of it all, we'd like get really, really mad. Like you know,
because they screwed up.
Like they missed a buoy, and we'd have to circle back.
Yeah,
I'm like, you know, we're gonna have to be out of here another 15 minutes because of you.
But your kids working in the mine.
Well, it was so cold, you know. You're like, don't miss it next time.
But the farm, family farm is the smallest minority in the country. Less than 1% of people grow up on farms. And the farm experience, you're always having to figure out something. Well, number one, you have to contend with nature, in a sometimes very violent nature. And you're always having to build things and rig things and how to fix things. It is an education in itself is to grow up on a farm.
Yeah. Do you think that's part of why your son's now becoming an engineer?
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
That child was a born engineer. He used to cannibalize all of Isabel's kitchen equipment. You know, where's my mixer?
He'd take the mixers and use the engines and I had a nice water bottle that I was very proud of. He turned it into a gas tank.
He built this scooter. He took this scooter motorized
my Patagonia water bottle.
It's now a gas tank.
Can you really be mad at him for that, though? I don't think you can.
At the time, I was. Once I turned on a light and the whole thing exploded because he'd cut the cord. This is when he's 1 or 2.
Yeah.
He'd cut the cord to see where the electric was.
We just to figure out,
when it was plugged in, right? So all of a sudden there's sparks, stuff like that.
Our daughter, we're sort of shocked that she's going to be a senior, and she's studying biology. She wants to take over the farm. And we thought, oh, man, she'd want to get out of here, all the work we made her do. And no, she wants to come back. I mean, she knows. I mean, does anybody know oyster farming better than our daughter? I don't think so. I mean, she's actually her entire life.
Biology degree probably helps with that, too.
That's right.
Yeah, it's going to help.
Well, she's also learning farm management. So she comes back and manages us.
So you're gonna have a professional.
Professional managing.
She's pretty good at managing us. She's very subtle, you know.
She's after being yelled at over the buoys all those years. Yeah. She knows.
But
she's gonna be able to turn the table.
It's already happened. Are you kidding?
Yeah, she's already telling us you're gonna make the delivery this week. I am.
Yeah, I've got a job in a hatchery. You know, she's working in a hatchery this summer over in East Hampton because we want to build a hatchery.
You know, is that's the big, more commercial, larger commercial size?
Yeah, I don't know, just to meet our needs, because every hatchery is also in the grow out business. And of course, it's human nature. They're always selling you their runts. They keep the best oysters for themselves. The fastest growers, they grow those out. And the ones that are slower growers or they're smaller animals, they sell to you. I mean, that's human nature.
Where does the process of raising an oyster start? I have no concept of this. Where what is step one for bringing an oyster to life?
You spawn the oysters and make a set. Then you collect the babies and grow them in nursery systems, in a hatchery or a nursery system. And after about, 6 months in the nursery system, they become large enough so we can put them out into the water. And then every 3 to 6 months, at least, probably more when they're young, at least every 2 weeks when they're young, we tend them, sort them, tend them, clean them. Then we overwinter them.
So when you say you're spawning, where is that? What does that mean? What are you guys doing when you're spawning oysters?
Actually, we do not capture our own set. We buy oysters seed at the size of 1 millimeter. That's the size of a grain of sand from hatcheries that do spawn the oyster.
Okay.
And what they do is they bring in, you know, a couple dozen nice-looking oysters, judging by the thickness of the shell and the shape and the rapidity of their growth. Bring them indoors in the winter in January. Pump in water in an aquarium-like setting. Pump in water, which they raise up to 70 degrees Fahrenheit, and that'll cause the oyster to spawn. At the same time, they must grow algae to feed both the big breeder oysters and the microscopic offspring.
Yeah.
So that's, and they capture those on very fine mesh screens, keep feeding them algae, keep screening them. And once they're at a size that we can handle, 1 millimeter, which is a very small size.
Yeah,
still.
Tiny.
Right? Yeah. Grain of sand. They ship them to us, UPS them, you know, FedEx overnight, and we put them in our nursery system. Our goal is to get them up to, you know, 3 millimeters that we can get them into little baskets out in the water.
So you start off with like a stud oyster, basically. It's like
about a dozen males and females. Yeah. Of course, you don't know. Oysters are hermaphroditic. They change their sex during their life.
Yeah.
And the bad news is when they're weak, they're males. When they're strong, they're females.
What does that mean?
It takes more energy to make egg than it takes to make sperm.
Okay. So it's healthy. Harder to be a woman.
That's what that means. Oysters are a metaphor, is what you're telling me.
Oysters are the basis of all life, without a doubt. The basis of all civilization, I'd extend that to.
And so you get these grain of sand sized spawn, and you take them and what are you doing with them at that point?
We put them in these containers that are out on the big tank, and we pump water in. At that, they release them to us when they know there's enough algae in the seawater. The water is now warm enough, which is mid to end of April. The water's still pretty cold then, but there's the beginning of the algae bloom, and we'll just pump water through them, keep them in silos that have a very fine mesh screen on the bottom. They have a 1 millimeter or a 750 micron mesh. Pump water through them. They'll, takes them about, a month or two to triple, and then they go into the, as fast as we can get them into the ambient bay water in containers, and keep sorting them and getting them into containers that have larger and larger mesh. That's our goal, is to get them, so that by September, October, they're in a half-inch mesh that we can then overwinter them through and pick them up in the next year to sell. So it's a two-year process to get an oyster to market.
It's 2 years in time. It's that little grain of sand speck. That's how long you're raising it for.
That's correct. Some we grow, for Dan Barber wants a big six-inch shoe, we grow four or 5 years for Dan.
4 or 5 years.
Also, Riyadh and Nasser at Franchette now is serving that big oyster, too.
So we overwinter quite a bit.
That's longer than you'll see some livestock. Oh, a lot of livestock.
Definitely.
Yeah. In the super cow and the super pig, they can get those things to market. A chicken is 10 weeks, right? They can get cows and pigs out to 500-600 pounds in 10 months.
Yeah.
It takes us 2 years to get an ounce.
But ours is good protein.
Healthy protein.
Yeah, but so each one of those little guys.
No hormones, no antibiotics.
So how many oysters are you like making in a batch? Like, are you raising at a time?
We do about 300,000.
300,000 to 400,000.
300,000 to 400,000 in a year. Obviously, from the 1 millimeter seed, we lose a lot to get to, from 1 millimeter to 25 millimeters, which is an inch, we'll lose maybe more than half of those. But that's how we expect to do that.
So you're taking hundreds of thousands of these little creatures.
Millions.
Millions of these little creatures. And you're attaching them to mesh to get them into the water.
Not so, attaching them, putting them inside a mesh basket.
Inside a mesh basket.
Yes.
And that's what I'm seeing floating around.
That's correct.
So I think we're going to start talking about gear soon. Because when I came out here, I honestly had zero idea of what an oyster farm would look like. Like, it just, I had no concept. There were things in the water somewhere, maybe some cages or something. And, if you look out over the water by your dock, it's these wooden pylons that are stuck in, and then these rows and rows of these black baskets.
Right.
Is this a system you've always used, or is this, you said your son kind of engineered something new. So is this relatively recent?
Yeah, the last 3 or 4 years, we've changed over completely. We used to use cages on the bottom. The cages had bags in them, and the bags had, you know, rather fine mesh from, you know, 16th of an inch to a half an inch mesh, and we would grow oysters in there. But the problem with that is there's several problems with that. And the major one is fouling. The cages are submerged in the water, and when the oysters are growing, everything's growing. Sponges, tunicates, lady slippers, barnacles, oyster drills, all kinds of lower life forms.
A lot of people like that system, though, and a lot of people use that system, and they get good results with
it. Yeah, that's true. But we found it very labor-intensive.
Is it like you're hauling cages up from the bottom?
Heavy cages.
We also are unique that we're right outside our house, so we own the bottom, so it's a very unique situation that we could implement the system.
Yes, we can grow close to shore. We're the only place, I think, in Suffolk County that can grow so close to shore because of the oyster, the old oyster industry that preceded us here in Greenport. The entire village was sewered in the 1920s to make sure the water was clean. Suffolk County out here, almost the entire county is on septic tanks, and septic tank leaching, you know, forces most growers to be at least 1,000 feet from shore.
So you got lucky, and that's
we got lucky, right?
You got lucky. You found that you had 5 acres of clean water.
Yes, very clean water, and of course now we're totally enslaved by that romantic notion of growing oysters. We work here, you know, 12 months out of the year. We rarely get any time off.
I still want to see if I can get this straight in my head, because you've got these baskets out there. How do you actually keep the oysters in the basket when they're so tiny?
The smallest
different size mesh.
Yeah.
Okay. So you've got ones with like tiny, tiny mesh, and as they get bigger, they've got larger mesh coming
through. We go from 1.6 millimeter mesh to 6 millimeter mesh to 12 millimeter mesh.
Ah, I see.
12 millimeters is a half inch.
Okay, so as they grow up, they get progressively more like breathing space. Why?
Exactly. They need more. They'll foul up. The smaller, finer mesh fouls up. You know, if they eat, right, they make waste, so you have to constantly clean those. But they rapidly progress. From, you know, we put them in there at 3 millimeters. We want to get them out at 10, and they will, you know, in a month or two, they'll go from 3 millimeters to 10 millimeters. So we'll get them into the 6 millimeter mesh. Another month there, they go into the 12 millimeter mesh, and then that's where they'll be for the rest of their life.
When you're moving an oyster from its first home to its second home, how are you doing that? Like those little guys, like how are you transferring them?
Well, we take the baskets off the line, we bring them up to the dock. We sort them. We run them through. We have sorters so that while we're handling them, we grade them out by size, and then we put them in the next physically. You know, they come out of the machine and in a bundle, and we put them into the next size up.
What does the machine look like? How does that work?
It's a vibrating sorter. It's a Tremblair in French. It comes from France. It's got different
size screens that and it shakes so the stuff sorts out.
It sounds like they sort them like almost like candy or something gets sorted.
Like potatoes.
Right? Like potatoes. Yeah. Is like France the technological hub for oyster raising? Or?
Yeah, I would say they're the kings of this industry by far. The French eat 25 times the oysters that Americans eat. The entire Atlantic seaboard of France is planted and farmed oysters. They have a mature industry. They have all the machinery that you would need. They have much more machinery than we have, the average French oyster farmer, because they're heavily subsidized over there. Agriculture is much more heavily subsidized in Europe than it is in the United States.
And insured.
Yeah. Crop loss.
Which it seems like that's a big deal with oysters.
Well, in Europe, they have a pernicious disease, a herpes virus, that they're losing 60 to 90% of their juvenile crop every year.
You don't have to feed them or anything. They just kind of live on
what... They eat the algae.
They eat the algae.
Yeah, they're good for the environment because they take excess algae out of the water system.
So as they're growing, are you tending to them? Are you watching them?
Oh, yeah.
How do you do that? How are you caring for the oysters at that point?
Well, we're so technically advanced. We put on our bathing suits and our water shoes and walk out there and look. Make sure it looks tidy.
If a basket is tangled, two of them become tangled, or if they become tangled, we untangle them.
Or the ropes are loose and not tight, so we just walk out there and fix them.
At the same time, we're harvesting almost all year round. So while we're harvesting, we have a full range of products out there between 4.5 years and 3 months old. So we are always going out and harvesting, selling some. Now our main harvest season, though, by far, it begins in September. That's the classic beginning of the oyster season. That's the first month that has an R in it. And that's the best time, you know, from September through April, that's the classic oyster eating season. And the colder water is the best time.
So how deep is that water where they're kind of hanging out?
At low tide, it's 3 to 4 feet.
So that's when you're going and checking them out?
That's correct.
So you're getting your wetsuit or your water shoes on, and you're just kind of...
It's like higher than 3 feet. It's 4 feet. Yeah.
So you're up to your like chest in water, and you're correct. Just kind of walking through the rows of oysters.
That's right.
That's a daily thing?
Sometimes, multiple times.
Yeah. It'll be multiple times in a day.
So every day, low tide, or multiple times a day, you're going out there. It's like almost like someone who runs a vineyard is checking out their vines or grapes.
It sort of does have the look of a vineyard, all the pilings and rope and cabling, right? Doesn't it?
Yeah, a little bit.
Similar.
Yeah, similar, but with shellfish.
Exactly.
Shellfish vineyard.
And you know what? The two classically are eaten together.
Right, yeah. Some Chablis and oysters.
Yeah. We could be growing grapes on those lines.
You said you're looking to see if they're tidy. What exactly are you looking for when you're checking out those baskets?
That they come out of the water properly, the lines are not tangled.
Yeah.
Fouling is something, if they're not, you know, just general health. Sometimes the purses have, you know, broken parts.
Yeah, clip may break.
Just like after a storm, you know, there's like...
We get big storms.
So they have a lot of action, so you really have to go back. And then we have to make sure that they're going to be able to withstand big storms. We want to have... You know, everything tight, all of the line. Because once a loose line gets out, everything...
You don't want a basket of oysters floating away.
The whole line of oysters will go...
They could get tangled together if they're not tight and then ship shape.
It could be a mess.
What happens if they get all tangled together?
They break loose, they're up on the beach.
They're not hanging properly, so they could unloose from the clip, and then they'd wash up on the shore, which we have... retrieved them, right?
Oh, yeah, at that point.
Yep, they're afloat. They have floats on them.
So. Yeah, that sounds like one built-in safety mechanism.
Yeah, that is.
Actually, yeah.
But you'd rather not have them
without
detach.
That, they would actually fall on the bottom, which is also easy to get. Anyway.
Yeah, but so you have to make sure they're not going to fly away in a storm. You keep describing fouling. That's just oyster waste.
No, it's tunicates.
Oh.
Barnacles.
Barnacles.
Lady slippers. Jingle shells.
Slimy growth.
Seaweed, sponges. Sponges are very pernicious.
A lot of sponges. We get a wide variety of sponges.
What do sponges do?
Well, they cover up the shell. They look ugly. They steal nutrient. And there is a type of sponge in the water all along the East Coast called Cleona. The old timers called it sulfur sponge. It's a microscopic, boring sponge that attacks the shell, burrows into the shell, and lives in the layers. We make the shell so brittle that it's, you know, the restaurant doesn't want a brittle shell. If it cracks, you know, the restaurants are not after protein. The look on the plate is as important as the protein that you eat. So the beautiful look, our shells are totally free of any fouling. The inner shell, look at it, it's glistening mother of pearl because they have had no predation, nothing has attacked that animal. So it's a totally healthy, beautiful looking animal. And that's what you want to see when you're served a dozen oysters. You want to see glistening white inner shells.
Healthy.
Healthy animal.
You're walking through and you're looking for any kind of parasite or other creature that's going to...
Well, we know there won't be parasites in the system because they air dry every day. We know that.
Okay. So you're looking for these other creatures that'll come in and possibly go after your oysters.
We're looking for the gear is properly rigged. Basically, we want to make sure that the system or the infrastructure is properly designed, set up as it's designed, and then you'll grow a nice
animal. Plus, we're interested in the growth of the oysters. We're looking at the oysters and seeing how they're doing. And I mean, you know, God forbid we get the herpes and you walk out there and see 90% of your crop dead, you know, so.
But like, for example, right now, this week, our oysters are going to spawn. This will be the last week we will deliver into Manhattan because after they spawn, they'll lose about 40% of their body mass and the meats will be thin. Huh. So we won't deliver into Manhattan until, you know, end of August, early September. And they fatten up and they're that same animal, you know, in the fall and winter is a beautiful, healthy, thick piece of meat, delicious. So we slow down our sales and we concentrate on the seed for next year.
And is that why it's seasonal? Because you're trying to deliver them before their spawning period?
Yeah,
in the fall. Most growers out here just sell. Most people just want to sell the oyster.
Yeah, we prefer to sell it at the right, proper time. And we've worked with a lot of chefs in Manhattan, and they want to buy the product at the proper time that it should be sold and should be harvested. You know, all food is seasonal. And
that's gone out of the diet.
Yeah, the great chefs know that, and the good chefs know that. And more people are beginning to realize that there's certain times to eat certain things.
It sounds like part of the name of the game is that once you have your kind of system rigged up, if it's working properly, that should keep them healthy. That just like if those baskets are cycling and moving correctly through the water, mm-hmm. that's what's going to keep. Am I right to think that it's sort of...
In our case, yes. But yes. Most people are using the cage system and their key is constant tending. If they tend it, they'll live.
They have to take them out of the water and air dry them. Then they run machines to tumble them.
The key is to keep your oyster healthy.
Yeah.
So matter, because every site is different. Every site's got different current, different bottom, yeah. different depth.
That's interesting. So with cages like you used to have, mm-hmm. you actually have to take the oysters out and throw them in a tumbler.
Well, they did. We never did. I never liked the tumbler system because it kills a lot of oysters.
Yeah.
But, you know, to match the demands of the marketplace for the little, smaller, deep cup oyster.
Most of the guys out here tumble.
Yeah.
Almost
Everybody tumbles. Even on the West Coast.
What is tumbling?
They put them in a drum and it breaks off the growing edge, so it forces them to make a deeper cup.
Interesting. Yeah. So
big long cylinder that tumbles the oysters.
Yeah. And so that, because you break off part of the shell,
yes.
it gets deeper. And that's how you kind of encourage growth with that.
Right.
Yeah. You're sculpting. And that's what this system is doing.
And so you have this system. How does this system accomplish that?
I didn't tell
them. Yeah. What is that?
We just try to work with the nature.
Is it a trade secret sort of thing?
Or,
I'm asking you to divulge a state secret. So you guys have a different system, though, that kind of does something similar.
Yeah, we've done a lot of trial and error, and this is what we've come up with.
Is this your son kind of helped build? Is this the...
Yeah, the son, our daughter, everybody is, you know, we've known, you know, because we go to the chefs directly, we've gotten feedback over the years and, you know, they want this, they want that. And this is one method that we can now...
You guys have figured out how to do it.
We think so. We've deluded ourselves into that.
Okay. Aside from the daily checks of the oysters and walking through and looking at them, how are you actually spending your time, would you say? What are the tasks that you eat up your days?
We spend a lot of time tending the babies, like the nursery system. We just shut it down. We've run this nursery system since, April?
Yeah, and so everything's now in the water.
So
however,
from April until just now, we have a on-land upweller system that we're growing the babies in, which requires a lot of maintenance.
And
you
got
to make sure the pumps are running, because if they don't go out, we ought to put a generator up.
So what are you doing to tend it? You're just kind of, you're going and looking at the machinery?
Thinning them out.
Raising them out of the tanks.
Cleaning them.
Yeah, must clean them every day. And then every week you must flush the tank and clean the tanks out.
And so then we thin them out.
Yeah, thin them out. Grow them in more and more silos.
Yeah.
Thin them out.
Keep track of their growth.
And then migrate them. Then once they're big enough to be sorted out, they go into fine mesh screen into the water. But that's where we're at now. Everything's in a fine mesh screen. Well, that has to be cleaned, twice a week now.
Yeah.
Tending the seed is a labor intensive.
Is a spring through summer project.
And it sort of works out well because what we do in early spring is we get all our juveniles up on the lines and let them grow. They're fine. Once they're up in the purses on the lines, they're fine. Now we tend the seed all summer. Mm-hmm. We get them big enough to be into purses by end of August. Then we switch to harvesting the mature animals that are a year older, or a year or 2 years older, and sell those. And the rest, that's all we do is then harvest until the next spring. Mortality.
Color, because you can tell if they're getting too much exposure to the weather by the color.
How long does it take you to figure it out? Do you just like take it? Is it just super quick? You eyeball it at this point? You've been doing it so long?
Well, they're all graded. You know, obviously, in a cohort of oysters that you buy, even if you buy one from one hatchery, they're all genetically cousins or brothers and sisters, right? But even amongst them, there's a bell-shaped distribution of growth. So when we first get them and we're sorting the juveniles, say they're 1 year old, we run them through a sorter machine, we'll get four different grades of sizes. We tag each basket with we code them so that we know which size is in which basket. So now as we're going along and looking at them in low tide, you can see they're tagged, we know the size, and they're all uniformly grouped by size, and we can see, oh, these are ready to go. Oh, these in 2 more months. Oh, these take 6 months.
You pretty much gauge when, especially Mike, he gauges the crop so he does marketing. He's got to match the amount of oysters we have to the amount of sales over a certain amount of time, so he's pretty good at that.
Call up our clients and say, okay, we're ready to go.
Because you don't want to get more clients than you can get through the season.
Yeah.
and you don't want to end up with extra oysters. So,
you guys deal directly at the restaurants?
That's correct.
Is that common?
No.
Yeah. How does it usually work in the industry?
They go to distributors.
Yeah, the grower grows, sells his product to a distributor. He keeps it in a cooler, and then they go to cities or all over the country and distribute and sell.
Yeah, they end up at like the fish market or something like that.
Yeah, or
they don't know where it ends up.
The grower doesn't know where it goes.
They give it to the distributor.
How did you start dealing directly with restaurants?
Well, we had a software business. We used to deal directly with our customers, and being in software, you realize that if you work with the end user, you get a really good idea of what they're looking for and their needs. So we started talking to the chefs when we first started selling to get an idea of what they're looking for, and they're very supportive.
Our office was on number one Union Square, and so our software business. And when we entertain clients, we always entertain people at the Union Square Cafe. Yeah. So, you know, after we sold the business, 3 years later, we had a bunch of oysters to sell. We called up Union Square Cafe, Danny Meyer's place. The chef was Dan Pollinger, right? Dan Pollinger, he bought 100. He said, these are good oysters. I bought 100. He called up Tom Colicchio at Gramercy Tavern. He bought 200. And then he called...
Dan Pollinger.
Ben Pollinger. Ben Pollinger. I'm sorry.
Correction.
Ben Pollinger. I'm sorry, Ben. My first client, I forgot his. You know. And then he called up Heffernan at 11 Madison Park. All at that time, Danny Meyer owned all three of those. And So we had 400 oysters we sold. We took them in the back of our Cadillac. And by the end of the month, that was all end of August. By the end of September, we had to buy a van because we were bringing in thousands.
But I mean, they were very supportive.
Yes.
Because I look back on what we were selling and it was like, gosh, you know, because they're fouled and they were very heavy because we were selling giant oysters.
Yeah, big oysters, right?
Because we thought everybody should eat big oysters, but.
Yeah.
They're very supportive.
Yeah. Yeah. So you guys, you started off
selling. We had relationships with the chefs.
Yeah, like that you knew this is where you had your expense account. You know?
That's right.
And at that point, they're like, okay, well, and you turned into a real oyster startup at that point.
Yeah, that's basically.
Well, the water here is excellent. I mean, you had an oyster. They're delicious.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Greenport has a good taste. It's a world-class animal. It truly is.
It's like I would say it's the best in the world.
What is the key to raising a good oyster? Is it just the
good
water?
Good spot is a lot.
It's just the location.
And then the how clean and healthy you can keep that animal. Keeping them healthy and clean is everything. Well, you can see there's our oysters. We're on the west shore of Greenport Harbor. On the east shore is that breakwater. What is that? 500 yards, 1,000 yards away, a mile away. That's open ocean. That's Gardner's Bay. So we get a big tidal flush, and the harbor is deep. The middle of the harbor, you see where the ferries are running to Shelter Island, that's 100 feet deep. So there's a huge volume of nutrient-rich water that's coming through here every day.
So that's the key. It's just getting the water coming in and coming out.
A good flow, a good flush, a good bottom.
And Greenport has sewage.
Yes, yeah. Clean.
Clean water.
So good, clean water flowing in and flowing out. And that's what keeps...
Well, we have hard bottom, too.
Yeah.
Sandy bottom.
Sandy, cobblestones.
Bottom. How does that help instead of like mud?
Muck.
Yeah.
No muck, no mud.
Muck.
Because then it tastes like mud. Is that pretty
you
much
got
it?
Got it. If you grow it in mud, it's
And it also kills them, too.
Yeah, mud does too. Bad. Oh, yeah. Muck is bad.
How does the mud kill it?
Drown.
Can't feed. Right? Oh, okay. Can't feed.
If they fall, if they're on the bottom, if they're cage grown, the cage will sink.
But if it had a mucky bottom, then the cage is only 4 or 5 inches off the bottom. Well,
cage will
the
sink.
Sediment. And the first, you know, the first foot of water is going to be really
and the cage,
a lot of sediment.
It'll sink into it.
Yeah.
And then you can't pull it out. We've had that problem before. Yeah. You can't get this cage out.
Hard bottom is good.
Yeah. So sand, lots of water flowing through it.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, this area from Riverhead out to Montauk was gridded off in the heyday because it had hard bottom. It was considered prime oyster growing area, which, you know, Mike read, nobody was growing oysters. Like, I think we were one of the first people... growing oysters out here.
Did you get anybody saying, like, was anyone curious about?
The old timers were like, they were all watching us.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'd have people come up and say, it's so nice to have the oysters back. We're all watching you.
Yeah, the old time Greenporters were very, very supportive. Now,
they used to have canneries. It was a huge oyster.
It was a big industry here. You know, and the old timers really remember that. Greenport was very prosperous. There were people in Greenport in the 20s. That owned townhouses in London because they exported so many oysters to England. And people just don't realize what a big industry it was. However, we've had problems, you know, the summer residents, the New Yorkers who come out here don't want to see you working in their Grundens. There's a real problem with, you know, working on the waterfront. We've had to go to court to uphold our right to farm. It cost us, you know, six figures fight the village.
That's fascinating. So the village, when you first wanted to do this, said, so people sued?
No.
No, they ignored us because they just thought we were like nutty.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And so, then we kept growing and then
We were working all the time.
We were working all the time. And then we wanted to build this dock.
This big dock. And neighbors didn't like, they stood up and they didn't like
really
seeing us
scene.
Working in our Grundins. I mean, we enslaved our children. I mean, it was really nasty.
They'd accuse you of enslaving
your our children.
Enslaving.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. You're describing with the buoy.
Yeah, exactly, right? And
yeah, I guess they must have heard me.
Yeah.
And the then mayor sided with them, and they put a restriction on our farming activity. And fortunately, in the state of New York, there's a right to farm law. We went to court, and the court struck down the restrictions.
And
at the
New
village.
York State Ags and Markets was very supportive.
The state of New York. And the state of New York told the mayor that if you don't leave these people alone, we're going to sue you.
Huh.
And so they backed off.
It was a very traumatic experience.
That's so interesting to me, though. Because
all your neighbors, like people that I've given canned tomatoes to and pickles, you know, like flowers, they stood up against us. And then the odd thing is people that I didn't even know, because it's a very small village. We had public hearings, like more than any other.
Oh, yeah.
We had two or three public hearings, which
which is unheard of. For one thing.
It's unheard of. It's like
no one else ever had that in the state of New York.
So we had people that I didn't even know that would stand up and say, like, you know, would speak up for us. On the other hand, there's people that I was so nice to. I gave them cakes. I'd bake them, you know. Fruit cakes.
Yeah.
Remember we fed them for years in this house.
We want them shut out of here, blah, blah.
So they're worried that you guys just being out here raising shellfish is going to bring down their property values?
Yes.
Because it was like, it was too industrial. Because I looked out here and, it looks like a vineyard.
You can't even see our neighbors behind us.
It's like from, it's kind of.
These are the people that complain. You can't even see them.
It's so idyllic when you look out at the dock. Like, I mean, I guess back then you had cages, but still.
Well, we were working out there on the point. Yeah. We were sorting, but you know, it's still.
I mean, like, because I told him, like, how much noise can a mom, a dad, and a 6-year-old and an 8-year-old make?
Yeah.
We just, you know, we're just physically unable to work more than 4 or 5 hours a day at most.
There
little
could
have kids
been.
Have to take, I mean, they have to take naps. I mean, they weren't even.
Anti-Wall Street sentiment. I mean, we did work on Wall Street, and so
there was some of that.
I don't know what
out
it was.
Here. I have no idea.
But I was talking to some Australian mussel growers that sold gear for, they were in New Zealand, actually. And they told me that mussel farms were 10 miles offshore. And I said, that's really a long ways and a lot of weather, a long commute. Is the water quality? I mean, how bad can the water be? There's no people. And they said people don't like seeing the mussel growers, so they have to go out of sight.
Yeah. Huh.
And that's in New Zealand, where I think there's, 20,000 people? And I mean,
A million sheep, right?
I mean, there's like, it's not a dense, when you think New Zealand, you don't think densely populated.
Yeah.
So it's everywhere in the world that aquaculture has a hard time sustaining itself because waterfront property owners want to look at kayaks and yachts and sailboats. They don't like seeing people in their Grundins.
Grundin.
And dirty boats. That's what they complain about. Our boat is dirty.
They said our boat was dirty.
Yeah.
What is a Grundin?
Orange
waterproof overalls.
Oh, and, yeah, those things.
They're kind of cute.
Yeah, those are like you see pictures of those all the time.
They're not fashionable, but.
So you had to fight for your right to farm.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Six figures,
but you did it.
It was bad.
We won.
Yeah. We won.
We won, and then the village decided it was going to appeal. Fortunately, there was a new mayor elected, and we had the right to sue for damages. So we said, "Well, drop that right to sue for damages if you don't appeal." And that's how now. But you know that was 10 years ago. The climate has changed. We have, you know, people love oyster farming now. When we started, there was one or two or three oyster farmers. Now there's 93 guys with permits on Long Island to grow oysters. It's a cool thing.
Oh, really?
Fashionable.
I started the Long Island Oyster Growers Association.
Are there any others around Greenport?
Well, you see the buoys right there? That's
our neighbor.
There's another guy around the bend, big oyster farm around the bend here.
What is your least favorite part of the process of actually farming the oysters? What's like the worst, dirtiest, least pleasant job? Mm.
Regulation. I would say this herpes thing has been very...
It's actually the paperwork. It's the...
Well, it's the this herpes disease and the obliviousness of the government that they are going to allow the import of diseased oysters that kill 60 to 90% of juvenile oysters. And that's being...
Is herpes related to human
herpes
in
some
way? No,
it's a different... people don't get it.
Yeah.
But OSHV1, that's the scientific name, which is oyster herpes virus number one, began in 2008 in France. It was the first big outbreak. And at that time, because of concerns about norovirus, we didn't allow any European oysters into the country. So from 2008 to 2019, we have not imported oysters from Europe. And they were going to begin the importation again this June, or last month. We went to Europe over the winter, our winter break, and it was just rampant. The disease kills 60 to 90% of their oysters. The Dutch were going to bring in container ships full of, you know, thousands of tons at a time. And they're all infected with herpes, and there's no, we grow a different species on the East Coast, but there's no research to prove if we're resistant or not. And the one researcher who's doing work on it in the University of Virginia said, hey, we're not totally resistant. I need more time and money for research.
Catastrophic is the word that most university professors will say. That would be catastrophic.
On, especially in the West Coast, where they grow the same species, the Crass austria virginica, that the Europeans grow. I mean, there's no resistance. The whole crop would just suffer massive, massive die-offs.
And so this is the thing that's this is what's bothering us.
Oh, you keep this up at late.
The trade was supposed to start in June.
We wrote an op-ed in the journal, and now
Wall Street Journal.
In the Wall Street Journal, and it stopped.
Well, they say
they put it on hold.
They put it on hold.
There's a lot of growers that are against it all over the East Coast and West Coast.
But there's a certain cadre of people that are associated with the lobbyists that benefit from this importation and exportation, the two-state, two-country deal, yeah, that are very powerful in the oyster industry. And they're apparently pushing it through. And most growers are just, they're reliant upon these bigger guys for seed. So they go along with it.
Oh, that's an interesting thing about the industry. So these huge hatcheries that provide you your seed to start have kind of divergent interests.
Not all of them.
But sometimes.
But the ones in quite a bit.
Yeah.
If you have big a hatchery, you can sustain a loss of 60 to 90% because you just produce more seed. But for us, we lose in March when we're cleaning out our juveniles and sorting them, we're losing 1%. And we really tend these things like babies to keep the mortality down. If we went from 1% mortality to 90% mortality, we would be out of business without a doubt.
And other growers would be too.
Yes, many.
Because it's an emerging, like Mike said, when we started, we were the only one of three, I think, oyster growers out here, two of which were old guys. And now there's 90 oyster growers, and the consequences of such a disease is unimaginable to most people.
And what's the benefit? There's no benefit. No economic benefit to bringing in European oysters. Absolutely none, except to perhaps the two states, Washington and Massachusetts, that are allowed to export to Europe. It's totally a corrupt deal. The offspring of big growers and corrupt lobbyists.
And our Congressman Zeldin has been very supportive.
Yeah. I mean, they were able to convince the USDA that an oyster is not an animal. Because the USDA's job is to ban imports of infected animals. And so the sort of Orwellian kind of newspeak was, oh, oysters aren't animals, so we can bring in infected non-animals. It's nonsense. They're living animals. It's the most heavily cultivated animal in the entire world is the oyster.
What did they say it was if it wasn't an animal?
A product?
Product. A shell.
A shell.
It was just so...
It was so nonsensical, they had to hang up the phone on us.
They had to tell us they had to go to a meeting and go.
Yeah.
So this is the thing that...
USDA.
Yeah.
So dealing with the USDA telling you that you're raising shells is is the worst part of the job right now.
Well, I've also had PhD types telling us... Actually, they've stopped doing that since the op-ed. But they're saying, you know, we import oysters from New Zealand and Australia that have this disease. So what's the big deal? You're going to get this disease anyway. So why should we stop...
What kind of logic is that?
So why should we stop the importation of European oysters, because you're going to get the disease anyway because it's a worldwide pandemic.
You want to do as much as you can to protect you from this virus or from this pandemic.
Like,
why be resigned? The only people that would be resigned are those that stand to have some economic benefit. No, they have a benefit.
Well, like Professor Langdon's, like, that's catastrophic. Stop it while you can. It's just unreasonable to not protect your crop while you can. They would never allow a African swine disease pig into the United States, whether it was being used as a pet or, you know, for leather or for
shrimp wrapped.
But they would never allow that animal in, but they're going to...
They can get online and sign our petition to stop the import of European oysters. Until more research is done. But you asked what part of the job is... some things that are hard, you would think they're hard, like like on a December, December is our biggest month. It's by far our biggest month. Christmas is the absolute best time to eat a New York oyster. You know, they're as plump as they're going to go into hibernation by Christmas. And so they're as plump as they're ever going to be. So we've got to harvest those at low tide. So if low tide is at 4 a.m, you got to be out there at, you know, 3:30 to go out there and harvest these. You got to get a wetsuit on. And the moon's out, the sun's not, right? And you're, the whole idea of the harvest moon takes on a new meaning. But I have to tell you, you would think that would be an awfully rigorous and awful experience. But I come in and I take a hot shower and strip off that wetsuit, and I just feel great. I feel like I've done something great. It's a good feeling. You would think it's awful, but it's not.
When you're harvesting them, are you just opening the cages and emptying them into the sorter, or how does that work?
By hand.
Do the last step by hand.
Most people are appalled, like the Europeans, they have so much machinery, they're like, you'd sort by hand?
So take me through the harvest. Yeah. How does that work?
Take them off the line, we put them on a raft, drag them over to the dock. That takes us about a half an hour to get roughly 3,000 oysters to the dock. And then we'll put them on the dock, dump them on the table, and sort them by size. Because we know our customers intimately, and we know what size oyster each guy likes. Unfortunately, there is a distribution, and we're growing different sizes for different people.
And you just go one oyster at a time through 3,000?
Eyeball it.
How long does that take?
Hours.
Hours.
Just standing there?
Yep.
Even in December?
Well, we put my son rigged up.
Well, that's another thing. The DEC won't let us build a shelter, and I'm like, where the... Everybody else in the world can work in a sheltered environment, right?
Yeah.
Oyster farmer can't build a cover and a sides to their dock because it casts a shadow or something.
You would think that's a conflict with OSHA, but would they demand that we work in an open,
yeah, OSHA says we have to have a cover, and DEC says we can't because of shade. And when you ask them, they look kind of embarrassed.
Bureaucracy is amazing in this industry. It's amazingly.
So you have to stand
and
up.
They're amazingly powerful. Yeah. You can't. Yeah.
Really bad, we'll bring the oysters back and work, you know. Okay.
If the wind is blowing, yeah.
But I mean, that's more time and effort to haul stuff.
But they won't let us build a permanent enclosure out there.
Yeah.
Because we wanted to build a dome, like, you know, a geodesic dome would have looked really nice and been hurricane resistant, hopefully.
Yeah, but, a dome is the most hurricane resistant shape there is.
And it would have been nice looking, and they're like, nope, can't do that.
So you have to stand out there in the open and sort one at a time.
You got it.
Try to stay warm.
Well, my son did rig up a system you can plug in your phone and listen to your music. So there's a loudspeaker system.
That's good. You got two.
Yeah, you got two.
That keeps us warm.
Yeah.
Is there anything else about the oyster farming business that you think listeners should know?
People should know that oyster cultivation is the most sustainable of all aquaculture and probably agriculture. Oysters don't take anything from the environment except algae, which is in an abundant supply. And actually, in most bays, it's in oversupply. So they're filtering the water of excess algae. And at the same time, as a byproduct, we are providing habitat for small fish fry. And basically, what we built is an artificial reef out here, an oyster reef. And the reef is the most, it's the place where fish are attracted. That way, between the interstices, between the shells of oysters, is where little fish hide from big fish. And so there's full of fish out here. I mean, when we lift up a cage, the bottom of our boat is full of young fry fish that we have to wash overboard because we've provided a habitat for fish.
Well, like the chef at the Greek restaurant, George, he told us that he thinks that the fishing in Peconic Bay is particularly good, and he thinks it's because of the oysters. I've had several people tell us that the fish have come back in this area, and they think it's because of the oysters.
Yeah, he's been diving here his whole life. He's lived here his whole life. And he's been diving in the Sound. And the Sound used to be much cleaner than the bay. Yeah. Now the Sound is dirty, and the bay is full of
life.
Full of fish. We're one of our chefs, Anita Lowe, she loves to come fishing here. And we are ourselves surprised at the variety and amount of fish that we can pull in, you know, 500 feet from our oysters. Just, what are we, weak fish, fluke?
Blackfish.
Blackfish, sea robins, bass, you name it. Everything is right there, right behind the oysters.
The oysters really give back to the community
and the water. The quality of the nutrition is unmatched. If you're going to eat animal protein, oyster meat is the healthiest of all animal proteins. It has all the metals because it's from the seawater. You know, six oysters provide you a week's worth of zinc, magnesium, copper, iron. There's more calcium than milk. There's no fat in, you know, there's no carbohydrate.
He's 100 years old.
Yeah, I'm out there. I'm out there. I don't know why I'm out there on a December day, you know, but I'm out there. And it is really healthy.
Guys, thank you for having me out here. And thank you for letting me try some of the some of the oysters.
The Widow's Hole oysters.
They're delicious.
That is it for this week's episode of Working. I hope you slurped it down with a tasty mignonette. I don't know what I'm saying here, but I'm going to keep going at it. I hope you slurped down our podcast. If you did and you liked it, you can leave us a review at Apple Podcasts. If you didn't, or you have comments or just questions about this outro, send me an email at working@slate.com. The producer on this show is Jessamyn Molly, who would like to actually, she has a special thank you. Usually I give a special thank you to Justin D. Wright for the ad music, which I've just covered, but she also has a special thank you to Teddy, the Osinski's very adorable, oh, is he a French bulldog? Yeah, a tiny, when we got to the dock to come see them, this French bulldog barreled our way. I thought it was going to slide off into the water. I swear to God, it was so enthusiastic. Anyway, the pupper was adorable. Special thank you for that greeting, and catch us next time.